Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I am Charlie Sykes. Boy, another busy day in Washington, and we are joined by Major Garrett, who is the chief Washington correspondent of CBS News. So you've been upwardly mobile. You went from White House correspondent to Washington correspondent. So you have the whole freaking town now, right?
Yes, and much of the country, too. So one of the things that will, I hope, allow me to do is spend a little bit more time on my podcast, The Takeout, perhaps create another one that's more rooted in Washington legislative history or Washington political history. Still trying to fine-tune the idea around that and then get CBS to give me a go-ahead. Spend more time out on the road differently than I did in 2016 when I was the day-to-day campaign correspondent. I'd like to do things that would situate me in one place for a little bit of time, talk to a lot more voters, and get a much greater feel for the texture of the campaign, not just catching every plane and showing up at every rally or venue and press conference and moving right on down the road, never getting a chance to reflect or talk to people about what it really means.
That sounds like a luxury in the media. I mean, what a radical concept, though, to get out of Washington, D.C. and talk to voters, because who knows what we actually mean. You know, it's funny because there was that the Morning Consult poll today that's suggesting that if you assume that, for example, Democratic voters are the ones you see on Twitter, you're getting a totally distorted picture, which is worth reminding ourselves that the Twitter is not real life, that there are people out there in the real world who may not, you know, conform themselves to the image that we all might have of them.
Well, that's always been true. It's very true now. There's many things you could fault my industry for, but one of them is snapshots that take on a narrative power all of their own, and the tendency to believe that every poll is equally valid. They're not, and that every poll number is telling us something predictive. Polls are about a moment in time. They have very little predictive value. They can be cumulatively valuable in telling you the direction or trajectory of a story or an individual candidate. But I know that I wish I had more time in 2016, though I attended more than 70 Trump rallies, Charlie. I met a lot of Trump supporters. I talked to a lot of them. I would just like to talk to them for longer periods of time and get a better sense of where they are and what their lives are like. And I hope to have a chance to do that in the next couple of years.
Well, your book, which goes up through the Trump presidency up to middle of 2018, is titled Mr. Trump's Wild Ride, which I was particularly struck by because when I had younger kids, Mr. Toad's Wild Ride was by far our favorite ride at Disney. I mean, right. you consciously named this after Mr. Toad's Wild Ride, right?
Yes, and it's also a reflection of something that stuck in my ear, Charlie, as I started covering the Trump campaign, which is unlike any every other campaign I've covered. I've covered 5 presidential campaigns, 4 presidencies. There were always acronyms or shorthand ways of referring to the candidate. Not in the Trump world. There was only one way to refer to Donald Trump. It wasn't Donald. It wasn't the Donald. It wasn't DJT. It wasn't Trump. It was always one thing and one thing only, Mr. Trump. Mr. Trump, Mr. Trump, Mr. Trump. Everyone close to him only referred to him in that way. On rare occasions, you might hear someone call him the boss, but most repetitively, it was Mr. Trump. And as I write in the book, there was even an effort by Trump's staff to get reporters to use that same phraseology. Mm-hmm. Don't call him Trump, call him Mr. Trump, okay? And so that is also part and parcel reflected in the title. Some people said, why don't you call him President Trump? Well, I'm not trying to be disrespectful. I'm just trying to play off the ride, but also talk about something that I'd never come across before. And trust me, when the Trump campaign came along, there were a lot of things I'd never encountered before. That was just one of them.
Yeah, I think we all encountered a lot of things we didn't encounter before. I'm going to back into this in a way because I was thinking back on the early days of the Trump administration, which was, you know, had that feel of just chaos. The news cycle was unlike anything any of us had ever experienced, and there was also an explosion of some really awful takes. And if you don't want to play, you don't have to here. But I'm thinking back on the incredible furor and hype around the Wolf book Fire and Fury, which consumed Washington, D.C., and yet, in retrospect, was an extremely unreliable account. And maybe foreshadowed part of the problems of covering this White House, which is that it is chaotic, it's leaking like a sieve, and people were willing to believe all sorts of things, whether or not they were true or not. So, it is part of the problem, isn't it? When you're in a White House with so many people, with so many different stories, and so many of them, like, just flat out bullshit. I mean, you're dealing with people who are, to say they're unreliable is a euphemism.
Yes, there's a lot to unpack there, but let's just start with this idea that there is something about Donald Trump that is so unconventional and so contradictory to our generalized expectations of how the presidency should look, how it should sound, and what its overall comportment should be. There is a part of his approach to the presidency and those norms that invites people to assume the worst about him, and people often do. Now, just because you're invited to believe the worst about someone doesn't mean you always should. And there has been a tendency to believe the worst about President Trump and to assume every little thing that looks unusual is by definition wrong. I write in the book, and I say this all the time when I give speeches about the Trump presidency, just because it's different doesn't mean it's wrong. It can be wrong, but it is not wrong simply because it is different. And this president clearly wants to be different, wants to be provocative, intends to use that as a way to weaponize his own rhetoric, to keep his allies off guard, to keep his opponents off guard, and to keep a lot of us either in a state of confusion or exhaustion or a little bit of both. And those who work closely to him, with him, sometimes aid and abet that, and sometimes are as in the dark as reporters who cover the White House on a day-to-day basis. I mean, when the president announced on Twitter that he was ending the transgender role in the American military, that took everyone by surprise. I made phone calls to the White House lawyers. They had no explanation. Pentagon lawyers had no explanation. Nobody had an explanation. Nobody knew what he meant or if that was the force of policy right then and there. Other moments like that have ensued. Pulling out of Syria, declaring victory. These things do catch people by surprise. So there is an unpredictability about it. But as I also write in the book, Charlie, that doesn't mean things haven't happened. And that doesn't mean there are things that are going to be with this country 10, 12, maybe 20 years from now that have already happened. The powers of the presidency are profound. And even when they appear to be chaotically used or employed, that doesn't mean things don't happen. And those things that have happened won't last.
Yeah, and they can be very consequential. Well, we've used the word, chaos to describe the White House. Doesn't necessarily mean people are running around screaming, throwing papers in the air. But you described a couple of things that appeared to be ad hoc decisions that did not follow any normal procedure, including a decision about Syria that cost the president his Secretary of Defense. Mm-hmm. So there is being different and there is being spontaneous, but there is also a pattern of, shall we say, of the president making decisions without either the full information, without doing the due diligence, without necessarily even being that concerned about whether or not is legal, which of course brings us to where we're at right now,
right,
where the president is apparently decapitating his Department of Homeland Security, not only because they're not tough enough, but apparently because he was enraged when they pointed out the things that he wanted to have happen were illegal, would break the law.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I quote former White House lawyer Ty Cobb in my book saying the president has some funny ideas about power and what his powers are and what they aren't. And there are a lot of examples that have been published by journalists and other books, my book, where there has to be pushback to the president on just essential limitations of the presidency and that federal laws have to be adhered to. Now, the president also has objections to how certain circuit courts, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals is his biggest whipping boy, interpret the laws. But the president does run up against that, and he has a sense of frustration and a very short fuse on things he wants to do. But that's not a universal observation. The president is still in Afghanistan. He wanted to get out. He told the country when he was saying we're staying, my inclination was to get out. With Syria, the president essentially explained that he had had this conversation with the military advisors on a six-month basis, and they kept saying they need another 6 months. The president essentially determined, and one of the things that's interesting about this president, Charlie, what he says out loud is exactly what he's thinking.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty obvious.
There is something refreshing about that, maybe refreshing or unnerving, maybe a combination of the two. But when the president basically said, I was being jerked around by my military advisors because they kept telling me 6 months, 6 months, 6 months. Finally, I said, no more. So when he says out loud, I feel like I was being jerked around, he actually means it. And there's also something I write in the book that I think is central to this whole question. The president gave an interview to Fox sometime last year saying, I'm the only one that matters.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the not in the George Bush way, that I'm the decider. Obviously, the president makes the final decision. That's always true. What the president said is not that. He said, I'm the only one that matters. Meaning all of this stuff, all of these policy considerations, all this back and forth runs through me, and my attitude at the moment is all that matters to me and all that matters to this process. And that's different than saying I'm the decider.
Sure.
Because you can decide after you've had a process and everyone's had a chance to weigh in. President doesn't always adhere to that.
Well, and you know, in the hands of another president, that might be refreshing. I have to admit that it seems unnerving, you know, given the president's shallow level of knowledge, his clear narcissism, his willingness to lie, his management by humiliation, the erratic nature of some of the decisions. Now, some of the decisions, you know, may work out well, as you point out. You know, maybe North Korea, you know, will turn out well. Who knows? Or maybe he is simply too naive. But let's just talk about in the beginning of the administration, and it does feel like it's got some phases, and see whether you agree, where mm-hmm. he comes in and clearly had not done, you know, much homework on the transition. So the White House staff itself was chaotic, was a mixture of a variety of people who, you know, perhaps were not the best suited for their jobs. But at least for a while, it seemed as if the cabinet was filled with, and we use this as the shorthand term, the grown-ups. You know, people like, you know, whether you're talking about, you know, General Mattis or even Rex Tillerson, who wasn't that great as Secretary of State, but other people who saw their role as, you know, keeping the president within bounds, mm-hmm. pushing back on bad ideas, these grown-up in the room phase. And as we sit here and talk today, it feels like we've moved past that phase where we're getting more and more reports of the adults in the room telling him, you can't do this, don't do this, this is not a good idea. And the president answering the way you just described it, saying, I want to do it anyway, whether it means pushing ahead with a lawsuit that would throw out, invalidate Obamacare, apparently over the advice of his attorney general and vice president, you know, whether it is whatever's going on with the border, where essentially he's firing everyone who, you know, would not agree to pursue his direct policies. He does feel as if he has become more the way you described him, but more so, untrammeled by the limitations and by the people around him. Do you get that sense?
Well, that's certainly true when it comes to immigration. His frustration is building. He knows that the wall, as he described it during the campaign, and like I said, I was there, I heard it, I saw the crowds respond, is not the wall that he described. It's not being paid for the way he said it was being described. Yes, barriers are either being reconstructed or in some cases added to where they were not before. But the wall as it exists, metaphorically or real, is intangible. It's not going to be by 2020. That's a conspicuous failure. Everything else he's tried to change in immigration law, also a conspicuous mm-hmm. failure. And what the president has done on immigration is enforced current law to the absolute hilt in ways that Barack Obama did not. Prosecutorial discretion, we have learned, Charlie, goes in both directions. Lenient and full bore.
Right.
Lenient with Obama, full bore with Trump. But he hasn't changed anything. He hasn't made this mess any better. He certainly talked about it, railed about it, used it as a political cudgel, but he hasn't solved anything. He hasn't been that great deal maker with the Republican Congress or now a divided Congress. And his frustration with that is boiling over. But you can see something on dealing with the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. He toys with the idea, essentially motivated by his acting head of OMB and his acting chief of staff, Russ Fott, and Mick Mulvaney, to take on Obamacare. And Mitch McConnell basically allows that to run around the track for 2 days and then says, no, no. And the president folds up. Okay. So it's not as if the president is not aware of either political realities or institutional realities or the need to not complicate Mitch McConnell's life any more than it already is heading into the 2020 campaign. So it's not as if he's not ungoverned or ungovernable, but his, let's say, either erratic tendencies or unpredictable tendencies are less, it feels to me, less harnessed. And if he's going to be hollowing out bureaucracies, remember, we have an acting defense secretary for a very long time. Looks like we're having one for a while. We have lots of actings in lots of other places, and we have lots of placeholder people. And one of the things you constantly hear, Charlie, is, well, we got to get more Trumpers in there. Well, how many Trumpers are there? And can you just can you live with someone who's not necessarily a Trumper and not assume that by enforcing the law or telling you the law exists, they're not there to undermine you? They're just there to do the job. How do you come down on that? Well, this White House and this president have a little difficulty coming up with the same answer on a day-to-day basis.
So what is your relationship with the president? Obviously, you had some association with him during the campaign.
Sure.
Do you get along with him? Do you think
it's professional?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't make friends with presidents. My job isn't oriented that way, but I am respectful of the presidency. 100% respectful of the presidency and the institution. And I've said this many times, Charlie, I am not one to make myself part of the drama around any White House. I'm not listed on the characters in this American play. Okay. I'm there to ask questions and get answers, and that's it. Yes, I have a visibility on television. Yeah. Yes, I have a prominence because of that visibility on television that makes me slightly more recognizable. But that's just a dimension of the medium in which I operate. So the president knows that. I have no trouble getting questions to this president, unlike some of my colleagues. And more importantly, Charlie, I have no trouble getting answers from him. And the part of that is, my estimation, the only value of a question is getting a news-making answer. And I don't have any problem with that with this president.
But are the answers true? The answers, I mean, your president has kind of broken the model. He's not the first president to not tell the truth.
Correct.
But he's Donald Trump.
He is Donald Trump. And one of the things I found with the questions I ask him, for some reason, he answers those directly and in a way that's usually reflective of his orientation to a particular issue, his thoughts at the time. And they tend to, maybe because of the way I ask them or because of the way he thinks about them, hew more closely to observable facts. That's not always true. Look, and I say this in the book, the president has something that's much more important to him than fact, which is memory. And what he remembers is what matters. Not what is, what he remembers. And that influences not only his relationship to facts and or truth, it also influences the way he thinks about economics. I was just listening to a podcast with Gary Cohn, former head of the National Economic Council. We had a lengthy conversation with the president about how many coal workers we have in America, roughly 60,000, versus how many solar panel installers we have, roughly 350,000. But the president is still fixated on the 70s, his memory. His mental memory of economy driven, if not driven by coal workers, with coal workers being a much larger share of the economy than they are today. And the president just fixes on those things. And that fixation is important when you're the president of the United States. It's eccentric when you're not. It's really important when you are.
So as a member of the White House press corps, though, you know, you've been described generically as an enemy of the people. The president is clearly going to be running against you.
Sure.
And you know that probably we're in this kind of a strange period where the media may be doing, or some of the, you know, mainstream outlets may be doing some of the best journalism of our lifetime and yet have the lowest public trust. How do you cope with that, knowing that you're working on a daily basis or close basis with someone whose agenda is specifically tailored to destroying your credibility?
Mm-hmm. So I have a phrase, Charlie, that I used to say long before Donald Trump came along. It didn't land with anywhere near the velocity it's tended to land in the Trump era. But it was true then. It's true now. It'll always be true. Credible journalism, meaning the emphasis on credible, believable, verifiable, long-lasting journalism. Credible journalism will always outlast incredible politicians, meaning politicians who are not credible, who are incredible by the classic right. definition of that word. That's always going to be true. I don't mind that this question has been asked. What is journalism? What is its value? Is it real or is it not? Because good journalism can answer that question 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Bad journalism can't. We like to practice. We do the best we can at CBS to practice the best journalism we can day in and day out. Are we perfect? No. But we do our level best to be as factual and as reflective of that day's news as we possibly can be. And that's our burden. It's always our burden. Trump wants to say things against us, but by calling attention, he's inviting scrutiny. Good journalism can withstand that scrutiny. And I don't have any fear of that scrutiny coming from Donald Trump or anybody else.
Have we lost the distinction, though, between journalism and the media? I was at a seminar where people were talking about the media doing this or the media's credibility. And somebody raised the question, what do we actually mean by the media anymore? Is Twitter the media? Is Facebook the media? Is every ideological website the media? You know, are journalistic entities able to distinguish their mission and their values from the entire flood of information and data and spin that's out there right now?
It's harder and harder to do that. And look, our industry has contributed somewhat to that, Charlie, so I don't want to hold ourselves harmless. Look, on cable news, and I was in cable for 2.5 years at CNN, 8 years at Fox, when you have essentially pugilistic arguments for the very reason that you want to have verbal volleys on cable just because you're filling time, you're creating a mixture of either entertainment or ideological jousting instead of news. We've blurred some of those lines ourselves. The media has become much more infatuated about entertainment and celebrity coverage than it was, let's say, 20 or 30 years ago. Donald Trump is a direct reflection of that. And long before Trump came onto the national political scene, if you look at the Gallup data from the late 90s all the way through up till 2012, you see Democrat, independent, and Republican assessment of the credibility of the mainstream media in steady decline. Across all three, Democrat, Independent, Republican. I often say, Charlie, when I'm introduced for speeches that, you know, my name is Major Garrett. I'm a modestly well-known person in an industry with declining market share and record low credibility. That's what I got going for me. You know?
and Will, for some time, so do you miss cable TV at all? I mean, what do you not miss the most?
Well, look, cable television is a treadmill of 20 to 25 live shots a day.
Right.
And that means a lot of talking on television and not a lot of reporting because you just don't have time for it. You're constantly updating the news, even though it hasn't moved very far in the intervening hour. That was one of the things that kind of made me mildly psychotic when I was in cable. And I left Fox in part because I'd been on that treadmill for 10 years, went to my very quiet life, was back as a writer at National Journal for 2 years, thought I would be a print writer for the rest of my life, as I was when I started my journalism career. And then CBS came along and offered me a job you can't turn down, or if you do, you've turned it down for the rest of your career across every outlet, chief White House correspondent for a major network. So I got back into it. And look, in the moment, if you know what you're talking about and you're immersed in a story and you have good sources, television is by far still the optimal medium to express what's going on to an audience that craves in that moment to know what's going on. And if you're good at it, you can be very effective. And I think I'm at least average.
But of course, I think people, you know, need to understand what it's like to be on live television. And, you know, let's say they have the 400-page Mueller report drop there and you're on live television and you have to do an analysis of it and tread water. And, you know, it's because what you're not able to say is, hey, could you just give me a couple hours to absorb this? I'll get back to you about this a little bit later. So
I do think that there is a tendency, Charlie, that I would like my colleagues in our industry, meaning television, to think longer about, which is, I don't know, is an acceptable answer. Yeah. Audiences will take that. they'll actually take it as something that's refreshing, as opposed to pretending you know or trafficking in conventional wisdom because you're not actually reporting or you haven't taken time to read it and just sort of, as you said, either treading water or flailing or just holding airspace. Well, yeah. If you say, I don't know, give me a moment to find out, I think audiences will accept that, consider that part and parcel of your job, and more respectful of them. I oftentimes say, I don't know.
Yeah,
no, sometimes on the air, I don't like it, but if I don't know, Charlie, I tell people, I don't know. I'll get back to you.
Yeah, the audience, I think, would accept it. I'm not sure about the news directors or the executive producers. Okay, so how many presidential races did you say you covered?
Five.
So who was the most interesting candidate that you've ever covered?
Well, look, I thought when I started covering the 2007-2008 campaign for the Democratic battle for the nomination between Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, John Edwards, mm-hmm. Joe Biden, Bill Richardson, and the lot, Chris Dodd, and among others, and when that got to its end, not just when Hillary finally dropped out of the race at the Portrait Gallery in Washington, D.C., but the convention, to see, to be on the convention floor, to see Senator Barack Obama go over the top and become the first African-American nominee of a major party in the history of the country, and to see the tears streaming down people's faces. Those were, I regarded them as non-political tears, as simply in this moment of history. I thought I would never see anything as consequential or as history-making as that, ever. And then the 2016 campaign came along, and just about every norm or everything we had expected in terms of what the rules were, what the boundaries were, how you survived, how you fought back, what money meant, what money didn't mean, how you built a campaign, all of those, every single one of those rules was shattered with brute force before our very eyes every single day by Donald Trump. And that campaign is by far the most eye-popping I've ever covered. The Obama campaign was quite definitely the most history-making campaign.
You know, this is interesting because, you know, journalism is the first draft of history. Mm-hmm. And because we're living through it and because the velocity is so fast, it is going to be interesting when historians have a chance to look back on the bookends that you just described, the incredible moment in 2008 where this country, with its history, elects an African-American president, mm-hmm. and how inconceivable that was, but also how inconceivable it would be that 8 years after that mm-hmm. the same country would vote for Donald Trump. And, you know, everybody's got their pet theory about all of that, but I have a feeling that historians are going to be really puzzling over that for a very, very long time.
Yeah.
And we've lived through it, and we don't fully understand what just happened.
We don't fully understand what just happened. What I, and this is not a direct answer. It's not even an indirect mm-hmm. answer, but it's something I like to tell my audiences when I give speeches about my book, having covered both campaigns. And I say, look, if you looked at the Obama campaign and the 30,000 people who showed up in Denver and the 90,000 who showed up in Northern Virginia the day before the election and the massive crowd at the convention on the of 80,000 in the stadium and all the crowds he attracted all throughout his presidency as a radiant display of American democracy, you then must also say that the crowds that Donald Trump drew, where I watched people stand in line for 6 hours to go inside a place where all the only amenity they had was working toilets and water and stand for another 2 hours to wait for a speech that would go for an hour and a half. So they're now clocking 9.5 hours before they're half an hour to get out of the parking lot and drive whatever distance it was to get to their home. You've got to look at those crowds and say they're representative of a democratic spirit as well. And a fully functioning, mature democracy had massive crowds, massive organization, massive turnout for two distinctly different personalities, messages, and orientations, not only to America's past, but to its future. And you're right. We are going to try to be, we are going to be sifting those two things standing right next to each other, because essentially in American history time, they're right next to each other. Yes, mm-hmm. they're separated by 8 years, but they're right next to each other. And they're as different as they possibly can be. It's as if one side watched, one part of America watched all that would happen with the Obama campaign and either was mildly interested or mildly unnerved and began more progressively unnerved and then enraged about it and said, now it's our turn. And that segment that wasn't motivated by Obama said, we are motivating ourselves and we are rising up and we're looking for the person to help us rise up. And that person unexpectedly happened to be Donald Trump.
You know, it is fascinating. You look back at elections pre-2008, and it is as if you are looking at a different historical era that none of the rules apply anymore. And I think it's going to be a very hard time for us to figure out, you know, how fundamentally the rules have changed going forward. As you mentioned, all of these norms have been absolutely broken. This book is Mr. Trump's Wild Ride, The Thrills, Chills, Screams, and Occasional Blackouts of an Extraordinary Presidency. Major Garrett, CBS News, Chief Washington Correspondent. Are you going to come out with a paperback, an updated version on this? More?
So here's the sad truth, Charlie. The book's not selling well enough, my publisher tells me, to justify a paperback. And one of the reasons I think that's true, and I feared this as I wrote the book, is for all the reasons we've just described, our country is in a deeply emotional place about Donald Trump. And those emotions are very distinct, and they are opposing love or hate.
Ah.
My book does not traffic in loving or hating Donald Trump. My book is a journalistic explication of what happened, who made it happen, what didn't happen, but the whys and the wherefores of that first 18 months. I hope over time it will grow into historical value and become cited, but as a commercial proposition, it's pretty much a failure.
No, listen, this is fascinating. This is fascinating because I actually did remember seeing a sort of a Venn diagram of political books that were you know being sold, and it was very interesting that there were two distinct kinds. If you hated Donald Trump, you went out and you bought every hate Donald Trump book. If you were pro Trump, you know, it didn't matter whether it was written by Dan Bongino or whatever, you were going to buy those that people did not want. The people in the middle, I kind of wonder whether or not you look at the cable ratings, whether or not, you know, CNN, which is kind of the, you know, neither fish nor fowl, you know, it's kind of fallen between the stools that people want a safe place. They want something that is going to confirm their bias. And this is a dangerous period for people who are looking for the sort of the nuanced, hey, on the one hand, on the other hand. And there is a question about whether or not those voices are, you know, whether there's a business model for those voices. So, I mean, that's a revealing moment of our political, era.
Yeah. And I wouldn't have written the book any differently. I knew going in that it was likely to fall into this commercial space of indifference. But I'm a journalist and I love what I do. And I love all the curiosity that goes into the journalism. There's plenty when you see the book, Charlie, that's interesting. That's never seen before. Interviews that you can't read anywhere else. One thing I will say on behalf of the book in these turbulent times of what journalism is and isn't, everything's on the record. Not because I've never used unnamed sources and I don't know their value. I do and will, and that's part of my job. But I thought that for a book like this, because it's about Trump and because it's in this era, it required a self-verification mechanism. And that's why everything's on the record.
Yeah, it's it is one of the scandals of our time, though, that Michael Wolff's book sold as many copies when it was
more than a million.
Such, but also incredibly sketchy. But then again, Major, just another reminder, life is not fair, right?
No, it
isn't.
One last thing I'll tell you, Charlie, is that book did me some very particular harm because I had a lot of things in process with the White House that were shut down completely
by that
after Fire and Fury came out. They're like, books are ruinous. Forget about it. Never mind. Even if it's Major, don't worry. No, never mind. Right. And so that just made it. It's not that I wasn't able to put the book together, obviously, or I wasn't able to get some really good exclusive stuff. I was. It just was enormously more difficult.
Made it hard for everybody. Major Garrett, thank you for joining me on the Bulwark Podcast today. I appreciate it very, very much.
Thanks so much, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.